Janelle Kraut Baker, the associate director here, and I'm with Matt Bloom, and he is associate professor in the Mendoza College of Business at University of Notre Dame. And your current research focuses on well-being at work.
That's right.
And then also particular attention given to their well-being in certain professions.
That's right.
Such as clergy members, doctors. Are there other professions that you're focusing on as well?
We're right now focusing on what we're calling the helping professions.
Okay.
We have a kind of broad definition of that. So it includes physicians, educators, Head Start teachers in particular. We're beginning to work with some attorneys, human rights and animal rights attorneys. Our initial interest was to try to understand individuals who engage in the work out of a sense of calling. They may not use that that term, calling, a sense of destiny or yearning.
This is something they were meant to do.
Meant to do, born to do, hardwired to do. Those are the kinds of phrases that they use. And that led us really to understand how many of these people, central to that notion of a calling, is a sense of service to others. So the first professions were clergy and humanitarian workers, international humanitarian and relief workers, and that just led us to some of these other helping professions, what we call helping professions.
Okay. So you've maintained that your research was born out of a conviction that work should be meaningful for everybody, that it should be life-enriching for everybody. And that's easy to see with helping professions.
Sure.
How are you convinced that that's true for everybody, or it can be true for everybody?
That's a good question, and it's as much a statement of aspiration, of what we hope. Part of it starts with just understanding that for people that work comprises a huge part of their life. They give certainly significant amounts of time, but they give significant amounts of their own self. Their psychological, physical, and spiritual energies, you could say. And there's enough psychological research to suggest that anything to which we give that much of ourselves is going to have an impact on our well-being and on the rest of our lives. So our conviction is that everybody should have work that is life-enriching. And by studying these professions that many people enter out of a sense of calling, and yet some don't have that sense of flourishing, if we can understand what helps them experience flourishing.
So it's kind of an accentuated case.
Yes, right. Our hope is that we can learn things about work in general that could help those kinds of work, trash collecting, road construction, housekeeping that we think of as more mundane. We can learn how to make those life-enriching work experiences.
And do you have a sense at this point in your research if there are principles or learnings that could translate into other more mundane professions?
Some insights. These are probably going well beyond our data, but there are some insights. And honestly, one of the insights is there are probably certain kinds of work that no one should do. That as societies, we should just find ways to get rid of those kinds of work.
Can you give an example?
Well, for example, people who have to pick up dead animals on the road. I've interviewed some people who, I can't remember their job title, but that's their title. And it's never pleasant work. You know, maybe we as a society should take care of that ourselves. And, you know, if the animal's killed in front of my home, I take care of it. But we're certainly learning that helping people connect their own life values to the work that they do is one way to bring more meaning to what might otherwise be very mundane work. That can be difficult, certainly. So think of somebody on an assembly line making tires, car tires. It may be hard to help them understand how some life value or belief that's very important to them connects to the work they're doing, but it's possible. It could be possible to do that. So a characteristic of these people who flourish in their work is that they connect deeply their core life values to the work that they're doing. So that would be one of the insights that we're seeing.
And when you're talking about core values, what sorts of core values are you referring to?
Well, it depends on the individual. If they're religious, then their religious faith tends to be a source of those core values and beliefs. Some of the people we interview definitely fit this notion of being spiritual but not religious. So they would appeal to some other source. The consistent things that we're finding and other researchers are finding is that people need to have a sense that these core values come from some transcendent source or have transcendent value, mm-hmm. that they're not of the individual's own design.
So they're part of something that's bigger than themselves.
Yeah, eternally true. They need to know that there is something deep and true and profound, mm-hmm. so that when they give themselves to it, they sacrifice for it, they can have some confidence that even if they don't know what good will come of it, that there is good that over time might unfold from mm-hmm. the work they're doing. Mm-hmm. And so people who don't have that kind of a background, sometimes it's more difficult for them. They don't have that deep source of wisdom or truth that they can draw upon. Mm-hmm. And so they tend to question more. Well, what is the lasting value of mm-hmm. this work? And we find that even among these helping professions. Whereas an outsider, it would be easy for us to say, well, this is the value in your work. Mm-hmm. For those individuals that do not have a sense of core values or struggle with those core values, even in that work, they find it difficult to see what's lasting and true and good. Mm-hmm. So they might ask questions like, well, okay, I saved this life, but there are hundreds of thousands of others.
It's a drop in the bucket.
Right,
or,
right.
Yeah.
Whereas those people who have that deep sense of core values and connection to their work can make sense out of the hugeness of the problem, but yet how their work still has value. Mm-hmm. It's not just a drop in a bucket. There's mm-hmm. something beyond that.
So, you know, maybe mundane work, mm-hmm. you know, dirty jobs would
dirty
be
jobs,
one
yeah.
side of the equation. How about people on the other end who, you know, are helping rich people get even richer? Have you looked at all about, you know, people in those types of jobs? How work can be meaningful in that sense, or are those the type of jobs that shouldn't exist?
I'm smiling because it's a really good question. I was in that profession before I went back to get my doctorate. I was mm-hmm. my profession. I worked for a large financial services firm. My job was to help make very wealthy people wealthier, and there was certainly no meaning in that work for me at all. There's somebody I know very well who remains in that work and does find fulfillment in it. Mm-hmm. And his sense is that these individuals have as much value as others, and that they have a right to being able to manage their money in a way that's in keeping with their wishes. He hopes that they'll be generous with their money, mm-hmm. but he still finds it fulfilling and still sees his work as helping these wealthy individuals, is helping them. So he'll give voice to it in ways of, you know, they've built an organization and this is a way to help them preserve the company that they've built. I will tell you that I very much respect the way he has made meaning out of the work mm-hmm. he's done, and I think he's very sincere. I know he's very sincere in the value he sees in his work. And it's been good for me then to disconnect my own values from the work he does and grant him the right to find value in it. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. So I think the kinds of work that, and it's hard for me to pinpoint some of these jobs, but would be the ones that would be degrading or dehumanizing. Those would be the kinds of work that I hope societies would find a way to do away with. Mm-hmm. But I think we need to allow people the right to pursue work that is fulfilling, that we couldn't imagine being fulfilling, mm-hmm. but they do find it fulfilling. Mm-hmm. And so in this one individual, helping wealthy people maintain or grow their wealth, he finds very fulfilling, and he's very sincere, and he's a very good man. Mm-hmm. And so I it's been helpful for me to respect that.
Mm-hmm. Now, something I think you'll often hear among people of means, you know, when they're employing a gardener or somebody who cleans their home, or you hear this with expat in developing worlds mm. as well, I'm giving somebody a job who wants a job. You know, they happen to be doing more menial, mundane work. I happen to be using my mind. What do you think about that sort of dichotomy, or the way that we've, you know, subcontracted our household labors?
Oh, that's a great question. It certainly, research tells us that it's certainly true that having a job that allows you to provide for the well-being of yourself and your dependents, having such a job is better than no job. Mm-hmm. But if that's the only standard we use, I think that's a very minimal standard that we should never accept. Mm-hmm. That we need to aspire to providing more for these individuals in the work that they have. Mm-hmm. Even though it's difficult, even though we may not understand how to do it, that we should aspire to more. So a mere job is not enough. Mm-hmm. It's certainly better than no job, again, simply because people may go hungry or go unclothed or without mm-hmm. sufficient homes, but we need to move beyond that. Mm-hmm. So I worry that allowing people to just use that as a standard causes them to overlook the deeper role the work plays in the lives of those individuals who are serving them, mm-hmm. and that there would be ways, and I guess I think I would say that there is an imperative to provide for a richer experience of work for those individuals than just, well, they have a job, mm-hmm. giving them a job.
Mm-hmm. Do you think Americans have an impoverished understanding of work?
I do.
And why do you think that is?
Oh, wow. I thought I was just going to get away with the I do. Yes. I think in some ways it's because we tend to invest so much of our identity in our work. We don't have a very rich theology or philosophy for understanding the complexity of work. Mm-hmm. And so we tend to flatten it in terms of making money, has social status, and so that we allow people to kind of chase after that. Mm-hmm. I think we feel guilty about the financial resources that our work provides versus what the work for people around the world provides. And so the guilt that people experience is difficult for them to deal with, so mm-hmm. they tend to just want to cast it aside. Mm-hmm. And I may be repeating myself when I say this. I think in some ways we expect too much out of work, and in other ways we expect too little. Mm-hmm. So we expect work to be not just fulfilling, but fun and enjoyable. We don't expect it to be toilsome mm-hmm. or difficult. Or we expect work to be nothing more than a paycheck. Mm-hmm. And it, as I started at the beginning saying, it's going to be a lot more in our lives than that. Mm-hmm. So if we can understand work in more complex ways, we can understand what constitutes good, meaningful work, what constitutes dehumanizing work. We can understand our own work experiences better. Why are some work experiences so positive and life-giving? Why are others so life-depleting? Mm-hmm. And we could have a collective understanding of work that allows us to support each other in moving into that work which is more fulfilling and life enriching mm-hmm. and contributes more to the welfare of others, and we could work together to get rid of the work that isn't mm-hmm. that's dehumanizing. Mm-hmm.
So you mentioned your own biography a bit. I think for every researcher there's a biographical element to yeah. your work. What made you decide to become a work researcher?
Before I worked for this financial services company, I worked as a consultant at a big consulting firm. We were hired to come in and help the organization improve its productivity, which I think usually meant we were hired to come in and fix broken employees. Mm-hmm. My exposure to people in many, many, many different occupations and jobs made me realize how few people really found work to be life enriching, found meaning in their work, mm-hmm. saw work as somehow a way to live out a purpose that they thought was important. And then in the financial services firm, I found myself falling into that trap of really trying to find meaning in my work, but chasing after it in very much the wrong way, measuring it by the wrong standards, and finding myself making really poor choices that ended up diminishing my own well-being and the well-being of my family. And so I thought, I wanted to understand this thing that occupied so much of our life, understand a better way of thinking about work, a better way of engaging in work, and a better way of creating work experiences for people. Mm-hmm. And so just then over time it evolved as I tried to understand work in this more complex or more nuanced way. So some of it was from my own experiences, mm-hmm. my personal work experiences of close others. And some of it then was the privilege of being an academic and being able to explore these things, you right. know, and think about them that I benefited from.
So can you tell me a little bit more about the project in terms of, you know, you have collaborators, what sort of data set you're working with?
Well, we're using, it's a great question. Our project is longitudinal, which means we will want to study people over many, many, many years to understand the unfolding nature of work experiences. Mm-hmm. We've begun by really focusing on three questions. So the first question is, what does well-being at work look like? What are its signature characteristics? And we draw very heavily on this burgeoning area of research called positive psychology. But we want to understand what the characteristics of well-being are within the context of work. Mm-hmm. And if they are different from well-being in other domains of life, we don't mm-hmm. know. The second question is, what are the factors and conditions that foster high levels of well-being, and what are the factors and conditions that diminish it.
Mm-hmm.
And then how does well-being unfold, as I mentioned, over a lifespan? What causes the ebbs and flows of well-being? Does it look different for somebody new in their career or somebody younger in life than it does for somebody older in mm-hmm. life? We're focusing, as I mentioned, on a smaller set of professions, but our long-term goal would be to understand it across all kinds of occupations. Mm-hmm. So we use surveys. We do lots of survey studies that give us a snapshot of many, many people's experiences. We use narrative approaches, which allows us to go very deep into the experience of a small group of individuals. Mm-hmm. This summer, we'll start to use methodologies that allow us to study daily life experiences.
Mm-hmm.
So we'll be able to focus kind of deeply into an individual's experiences for 2 or 3 weeks at work. And we'll do a number of those kinds of studies to understand the nuances of work experiences mm-hmm. and how they shape well-being.
Mm-hmm.
And then we'll probably employ other methods as we learn from the ones we're using now.
Sure. So you mentioned resonance with core values as one of the factors mm-hmm. that enhances well-being. What are some other factors, you know, that you've learned at this stage in your research that might enhance or inhibit well-being?
Well, one of them that's probably obvious for many people is mastery, an ability to feel efficacious in one's work,
mm-hmm.
To feel like you can do your work well. That combines with this core values notion in that giving our best selves to something that we really care deeply about
mm-hmm.
seems to be a key feature in fostering mm-hmm. high levels of well-being. So somebody that can do a job well, but they find no value in it, is almost in a worse situation because they find themselves giving deeply of themselves
mm-hmm.
and wondering, what value is there in all mm-hmm. this that I'm doing and all this hard work that I'm
mm-hmm.
putting in? So mastery combined with this sense of purpose mm-hmm. or contributing
mm-hmm.
to something that matters. A sense of what makes my expression of this occupation unique, but what also makes my expression of this occupation similar to others.
Mm-hmm.
So this idea of what we call a personal identity, my own uniqueness, and a social identity, what makes me like others, seems to be really important. So
mm-hmm.
with our clergy, what we find is those clergy who are flourishing could say something about what makes their own expression of ministry unique,
mm-hmm.
but they also want to understand how the work they do in ministry is carrying out this greater cause of ministry. In other words, what makes them similar to other pastors.
How they're contributing to the profession in general.
Yeah, exactly. And how much people within any profession, and probably in many occupations, need that sense of, as Wendell Berry would say in his novels, a sense of membership.
Mm-hmm.
These are the people that can help me understand how to grow in my practice, how to pursue higher levels of excellence. These are the individuals that can help me, remind me of the true reasons that we engage in this practice from the very beginning.
Mm-hmm.
These are the individuals who can truly help me celebrate when I'm being effective or grieve with me when I'm challenged in my work.
Mm-hmm.
So it's not either or. It's not just, oh, this is what makes me unique or this is how I'm like everybody else, but the meshing of those two together that seems to be very, very important but difficult for people to achieve.
Mm-hmm.
The combination of the two and intermingling those.
So how about more mundane considerations that people often consider with work in terms of how many hours they're putting in, what their office looks like?
Yeah, those things matter, but certainly just at the margins.
Okay.
So if your work isn't fulfilling at all, those things are going to rise to the top
mm-hmm.
because it's all you can expect from work.
Mm-hmm.
If you find no meaning or fulfillment in your work, you're more likely to be frustrated by your pay. You're more likely to be irritated by a plain or frustrating office. Those things, because you have nothing else from work, those things are going to loom larger in
mm-hmm.
your life. Whereas if you find fulfillment in your work, those things seem to fade in terms of their significance.
Mm-hmm.
Sure, you'd like an office with a window, but not having it isn't that bad. If your work is unfulfilling, then that could be something that really weighs heavily on you. So I think it's because there's not that deeper connection to your work.
Mm-hmm. How about money in terms of how much does that factor into people's sense of well-being at work?
Over the short run, it can matter a lot. Over the long run, it matters very little.
Okay.
So let me say it differently. A raise will make you happier in your work, but for a very short period of time.
Okay.
More money will help you feel better about your work for a very short period of time. Now, to be sure, if you don't make enough money to provide for the well-being of yourself and others, that is a long-term problem.
But so
that,
it's sort of a, once you cross a threshold.
Yeah, it does. I think in many organizations, money is the main or maybe the only indicator people have of the quality of work they're doing, mm-hmm. or more importantly, of the their value to the organization.
Mm-hmm.
So the reason they become so distraught about money is because they have no other way of knowing, what is my value to this organization? Am I contributing and making a difference?
Mm-hmm.
So money then really is a proxy for a deeper need that people have, this need to find fulfillment in their
mm-hmm.
work, their need to feel like they're doing something that's valuable, the
right.
need to know they're making an important contribution.
Mm-hmm.
But in many organizations that are so impoverished, money is the best that they can expect.
Right.
And that's why they cling to it so much.
Mm-hmm.
But it will never be fulfilling.
Sure.
It won't provide that sense
mm-hmm.
of life enrichment, of fulfillment, of purpose.
Mm-hmm.
But that's the best they can look for.
Mm-hmm.
Kind of a paradox for us that we've discovered is that in many of these helping professions, one of the challenges for individuals is understanding, and these are my words, not necessarily our respondents, what kind of sacrifice is actually positive and good for one's experience of work? And when you tip over into a sacrifice that is negative, and by negative I mean will diminish your well-being. So what we're finding is across these professions, for people that are religious and those that aren't, one of the important characteristics, one of the ways they know they're in work that is a calling, is a sense of giving deeply of themselves, and they often use the word sacrificing.
Mm-hmm.
I think in part it's because it feels good to give very deeply of ourselves, but I think in part it's a way for them to know they're not in it just for the money or just for the personal things they get. Sacrifice reminds them that they really are giving of themselves, and that's really important. And also because this work is very difficult and requires experiences in which you do have to give up the things that you might otherwise want to do, or in some cases, you know, deplete yourself, you know,
mm-hmm.
work long, long hours. This is what humanitarian workers might do in an emergency situation. Work very long hours. Work when you've suffered an injury because the needs of others are so great.
Mm-hmm.
But then there are these experiences of sacrifice that we could see as diminishing the individual's well-being. But the individual can't tell the difference between that sacrifice that is important and necessary for the work and the sacrifice that now, in my words, is negative, has
mm-hmm.
tipped over into this diminishing of their well-being. It's hard for people to know when they've crossed that boundary.
Mm-hmm.
And so burnout is something that creeps up on people. By the time they recognize it, they're kind of in full-blown burnout.
Right.
And I think one of the reasons is because this tipping point of positive to negative burnout goes unnoticed.
Mm-hmm.
And we're finding it tends to happen more in people that have religious background.
Because they expect a high degree of sacrifice for
right.
themselves.
And again, these are my words, so please, no, I don't think they have a good theology of sacrifice.
Mm-hmm.
And so they can appeal to martyrs who've given their lives, they can appeal to biblical stories of individuals whose sacrifice caused either the loss of their own life, you know, the loss of a family, and they somehow, I think, understand that to be the standard of what constitutes a maximal sacrifice.
Mm-hmm.
And so they don't understand, they don't have a way of understanding a different kind of sacrifice where they would move from this, what I call positive to negative.
Mm-hmm.
So there's a tendency to give too much. And I think sometimes then they're called out as martyrs and they don't want to see themselves as martyrs. And so they kind of get, they don't get any help on the other side of it. Oh, you just have this martyr complex.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't think they do at all.
Mm-hmm.
So they have an impoverished theology of what constitutes an acceptable or appropriate or worthy sacrifice.
Mm-hmm.
And then we don't have a lot of good stories of people who didn't give at all. We have stories of those who did.
Right.
And we hear lots of stories about the disciples and, you know, how they gave their life for the cause.
Mm-hmm.
And it's hard for people to come up with stories of folks who just didn't go all the way, if you will.
Mm-hmm. So what's the interface for you between your role as a social scientist and then this theology of vocation that you're exploring in your role here in the seminar at the Institute? And you've also just, you know, mentioned some of your own theology and some of these
mm-hmm.
issues. How do these two areas of interest and passion for you merge?
Well, being a part of the seminar here has blessed me professionally and personally in ways I don't think I could fully do justice to. Part of it is because this notion of well-being at work requires multiple perspectives. You know, just the science perspective alone will not help us to understand it, will not help us to answer the questions we would like to answer, and certainly won't on its own help people live in to well-being. We need these multiple perspectives. And I've appreciated having theologians and philosophers who have engaged in this deep thought about these experiences and are willing to wrestle with the more difficult questions. So that part has been really extraordinary. Mm-hmm. And it's enriched the frameworks that I can use and that I can bring to the study, just the science part of it alone. Being a part of the seminar helps me step out of my own mindset to think about it from a more broad perspective, which allows me to see things I wouldn't have otherwise. We were just speaking today, cautioning ourselves about some of the assumptions we're making about what is required for somebody to experience vocation. We were talking about, do people need to be able to be self-reflective? Do people need to be able to be introspective? And we cautioned ourselves, is that something that arises from our backgrounds, our own ability to do that, our own interest in doing that? And I appreciated having that kind of that background that allows me to step back and look at my own thinking and say, am I making assumptions about this work, about what I'm finding, about the data itself that I need to be aware of that somehow reflect my own background? And the other one is that science doesn't provide the kinds of tools or resources that people will need to find meaning in their work. They'll need this richer and different experience that they can have through theology. Science can inform the kinds of things that they can do, but they'll need theology to be able to really experience it, to form the sort of foundational beliefs, to have the mindset, the worldview that they'll need to find meaning in their work. And science just won't be able to do that.
Mm-hmm. So your research can tell us that meaning is important, but it can't tell us what that meaning is.
Absolutely.
So your project here at the Institute is on vocation across the lifespan.
Mm-hmm.
What sort of work are you doing as a team, and what are you finding about vocation across the lifespan?
I think we wrestle with what are we finding in many ways. It's wonderful to be a part of a group that will accept chaos and uncertainty and mystery, even as we feel like we're moving towards some sort of deeper mm-hmm. understanding. So we've divided up, I think part of the reason we looked at it as a lifespan is just because we knew this was incredibly complex. We just had to have some way to divide up human life. And so mm-hmm. we thought about vocation in these different periods of life.
Mm-hmm.
For example, we're talking about elderly now. We'll read deeply about elderly. We'll read lots of different kinds of work about elderly. Then we'll get together and talk about this stage of life. What are the characteristics of this stage of life? What are the unique challenges and opportunities at this stage of life? And then wrestle with, what does vocation or calling look like at this stage?
Mm-hmm.
And what we're pushing to is to try to understand, are there some universals of vocation that extend across the lifespan? We'd like to see what those are like. What are the unique expressions of vocation at different lifespans? And how could we understand kind of the boundaries on those different experiences, how they might differ and where those experiences are? And then what are some of the factors that help people to either experience vocation or prevent them from experiencing vocation? Again, what are the universals across the human life, and what are some of the uniquenesses of these different experiences mm-hmm. of life? So that's been really extraordinary.
Mm-hmm.
And I think we probably would say we have a lot more questions now than when we started, but mm-hmm. I feel like we're also arriving at some insights that are just sort of nascent and budding.
Mm-hmm.
And we're close, and we'll keep pushing towards them in hopes that they'll come out.
So how does your background and your research inform what you're doing in this seminar?
There are times I feel like I don't have much to offer. These are such extraordinary people. They've been so welcoming to my perspective as a social scientist. We read social science. We wrestle with it. So it's been a privilege to be able to bring that perspective and have it honored and desired. I think my role is to bring that perspective to try to help illuminate some of the things we're talking about. But then each one of us, given our unique backgrounds and experience, I see the group working very hard to then integrate our perspectives.
Mm-hmm.
And so part of what we do is bring an expertise, but a humility. where we can draw upon other perspectives and integrate those with our own, or we can point to the shortcomings of our perspectives that other perspectives fill, or richness other perspectives bring. So I certainly come to this as a social scientist, and I think I'm expected and encouraged and welcomed to bring that perspective. Mm-hmm. But then the openness that we experience with each other helps us to find those connections, those integration points. Mm-hmm.
So what have you learned so far in your social scientific research about well-being across the lifespan? Or is it too early to tell?
Oh, yeah, I think it's... I want to say it's too early to tell. I wonder if that's a cop-out. You know? One of the things I guess I've learned, or that's been confirmed, is that well-being is a fundamental human need. It isn't selfish, although it can be pursued in selfish ways. Mm-hmm. So we tend to divide well-being into at least two big chunks. One is a sense of meaning and purpose of living a noble life. Mm-hmm. But the other piece we often call happiness, experiencing positive moods and emotions. And the research tells us that daily happiness is important. Mm-hmm. That doesn't mean that periods of grief or suffering are bad for us. They're certainly a part of life, and there's mm-hmm. much richness that comes from that. But this research says that if the rhythm of our lives is characterized predominantly by negative moods and emotions, that is not good for us. Mm-hmm. And so it's a basic human need. Mm-hmm. And to have theological perspectives that complement that and that reinforce that perspective, that help us understand abundant life is a basic human need or basic human right, has mm-hmm. been really wonderful. Mm-hmm. So I'd say that's a part of it. And then the role that other people and societies can play in either helping individuals find well-being, or that... are obstacles or that stymie an individual's well-being. And that the importance of how groups and societies can help or diminish a person's experience of well-being across a lifespan. So today we talk about the elderly and how certain social mores, certain social expectations can make the pursuit of well-being or the experience of well-being in the elderly years more difficult. Our society's kind of worship of youth, for example, can make just the aging process and the bodily changes that we experience as we grow older, that can diminish older people's well-being, because we, as a society, somehow tend to suggest that older bodies are repugnant, for mm-hmm. example. Mm-hmm. So that society owns some part of each individual's well-being. And we're seeing that in our research, and we're certainly seeing that in some of these theological accounts that we read. Mm-hmm. The things we could say the most about well-being is that it is a basic human need, something that we all should experience over a lifespan, and that our own pursuit matters, the choices we make, but the cultures and societies and contexts that we live in own some part of our own well-being and of each other's well-being. Mm-hmm. It's fundamentally interconnected, maybe. Mm-hmm. So that may have just been another way of finessing that. I don't know.
The answer. And how about on a personal level, what do you find meaningful about your work?
I find hundreds of things. I feel blessed to be trying to help individuals experience life and work in a richer and more fulfilling way. You know, there's a direct connection that I'm grateful to have. Mm-hmm. And I feel very privileged that the organizations that we're working with, the Lilly Endowment and all of the people that the Lilly Endowment puts us in contact with, we have the privilege of being able to work with those organizations and see our research turn into practice. Mm-hmm. Something that I hadn't anticipated is how meaningful it is to hear individual stories, these life narratives that I talked about. Just what a blessing it is, what a gift it is of each time we hear an interview that somebody's giving us this rich gift of their life. Mm-hmm. That's extraordinary. And seeing the way that individuals can find and do make meaning in work that would be very difficult for me, mm-hmm. in toilsome work. And it's amazing to see how resilient people are, you know, the kind of grace that people bring into their work is just so profound, and reminds me of the best that you can see in people in these difficult mm-hmm. situations. And I think part of it is just the privilege of being in a project that we can aspire to something like we want to help make every person's work experience life enriching. and not have people kind of say, well, that's ridiculous. And people say, well, that's great. Even though it's something we know is bigger than our project and probably bigger than our lifespans, it's really wonderful to be a part of something that you can aspire to, something so lofty or such a big dream, be considered seriously by others in that pursuit.
Well, it seems like something that could resonate with a broad swath of people. You know, everybody works, no matter whether you're conservative or liberal.
That's
or,
right.
You know,
male,
your
female,
ethnicity.
You know,
right. That it's really broad-ranging.
We hope so. We hope so. And it certainly changed the way I interact with anybody in their work. Anytime I'm interacting with somebody in their work, I'm thinking about our research and meaning and wondering how my interaction with them is shaping their own experience of happiness and meaning in that moment. It certainly changed that a lot. And I hope I'm a better customer or a better patient, you know, better passenger on an airline. I hope I'm better because I think of it in that way. And that's wonderful and feels like a blessing too.
Right. And that somebody isn't there just to serve you, but you know, they're a person with their own needs and dreams and desires.
That's right. Oh, well said. Very well said. So I don't flatten these people into just, oh, the person that I'm paying for gasoline. But it's a real blessing now to see that person as a whole person, or at least imagine that this is an experience that they're having. And that's nice. It's a challenge for me. I'm not as good at it as I want to be, but I appreciate that.
Well, thank you so much for this conversation. It was really fascinating to hear about your work, and all the best as you move forward with it.
Thank you. It's been a real privilege to talk to you.
Great,
I appreciate
thanks.
It. You're welcome.